the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
The Peter B. Collins Show is supported by listeners. Today we credit Rick and Catherine Arndt of Boise, Idaho, and Russell B., who emails us F. Zappa from Royal Oaks, Michigan. And today we're going to do something completely different. There'll be a little bit of a political element to what we're about to discuss, but we're going to take a look at the history of punk rock here in San Francisco. Authors Jack Boulware and Silka Tudor join me for this exclusive special podcast on the Peter B. Collins Show. We're starting off with the DKs, the Dead Kennedys. Oh, and the explicit lyrics warning, this program will contain profanities, so fucking get over it. Kiss ass or crack. I remember that line. It comes up later in the song. Jello Biafra and the Dead Kennedys. Jack Boulware is here at my secret studio. Don't disclose the location, Jack, okay? It'd be a real punk thing to do.
Mum's the word.
He took the ferry over today, though, and that was quite an adventure for him. And he, along with Silka Tudor, who joins us by telephone from the Big Apple. Hi, Silka.
Hi, Peter.
Great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I am really enjoying Gimme Something Better. This is the book that you and Jack have spent years on, and you published, what, half of what you actually collected, Jack?
A little over half ended up in the book itself.
Yeah. And it's called Gimme Something Better, subtitled The Profound, Progressive, and Occasionally Pointless History of Bay Area Punk from Dead Kennedys to Green Day. Now, we've been battling subtitle creep on this program, but that's a rich subtitle.
It's a long subtitle,
for sure. It is. It is. But I think it is important to make that connection, that the DKs are really on the early edge, and Green Day is the product of the punk movement here in the Bay Area that is best known, most widely, commercially acceptable, and helps, I think, define things in a certain way. Would you say, Jack?
I would say that. The publisher has heard of Green Day. That was one of the reasons why we would put that on the cover. Also, they've sold 80 or 100 million albums.
Mm-hmm.
There's an audience for anything Green Day.
Yeah.
And we put the Dead Kennedys on there because outside of Green Day, they're probably the next best known band to emerge out of the punk rock Bay Area punk rock scene.
Yeah.
But that does not mean the book starts at the Dead Kennedys.
True.
And it doesn't mean that the book is only about the Dead Kennedys and Green Day, which we have heard all the rumors, especially from people who haven't read the book. Why does it have to start with the Dead Kennedys? It doesn't. It starts in the mid-70s.
Well, but now, first of all, if there weren't dissension it wouldn't be punk, right? I mean, you don't expect people to just accept this as a homogenized product and say, hey, great job, you guys really nailed it. Everybody has a different view of the punk scene, what was legitimate punk, who was selling out, whether Howie Klein was a hero or a monster, and your book reflects that. I mean, in one section, I read somebody just trashing the hell out of Howie, and we got a Howie Klein quote about three pages later.
I think I'll let Silke answer that, the what it's like to interview people and put together a book with their words with, you know, an overwhelming attitude of distrust.
Mm-hmm. Well, and talk about that and also orthodoxy, because what Jack was just describing there is a kind of each person has their own sense of punk orthodoxy. And if you violate that, they scream obscenities at you. Silke?
Well, definitely if people were not outraged, we would have done something wrong. You know,
right.
There had to be outrage involved, but it is some of what was edited out was sort of this toggling back and forth between contrary opinions. You know, you have like six different people just one after the other contradicting each other about the same moment in time, the same band, the same show. You know, everybody's memory is different. Everybody's opinion is different. And I think Jello Biafra talks, has a quote in towards the end talking about how vastly different everybody's outlook on punk was and why people came to it and what they got out of it. And I hope, or at least we definitely tried to the best of our ability to have all of those different viewpoints represented, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So people will be hopefully angry.
Well, the other thing that we have to account for is the levels of normalcy versus levels of, say, intoxication, inebriation, drug use. And so, you know, one of the people who's frequently quoted in your book is Sheriff Mike Hennessy of San Francisco. He's been sheriff for 97 years now. And it's so cool to know that he was, you know, catching the punk scene and really into it. But I imagine that he was one of the straightest people at the Mabuye Gardens or on Broadway or any of these venues. And so his recollections might actually be a little more objective than some of the individuals who were part of the scene, in a band, a fan of a major act. You know what I mean?
Well, it was fun. Silke did an interview him. I went to City Hall and interviewed him in his office, his sheriff's chief, you know, office. And he has punk rock posters all over his office, which is, I think, unusual for a law enforcement officer. Anyway, he still listens to punk when he works out. He tells me, we just spoke to him not long ago, actually. But his view of things, we really love to put it in the book because he does sound like a really straight-laced guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't tweaking on speed. Right. He wasn't shooting up. He wasn't in a band. He wasn't up for 4 days.
Well, we think not.
We think not.
Let's leave a little mystique for the sheriff, all right?
But there's one great quote that he said. He was something he called some of the one of the bands was really popular with the rebellious youth types,
mm-hmm.
which is not a phrase that anyone else in the book would ever say.
Yeah.
Rebellious youth types.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he also we asked him what was going on with the police versus the punk situation. There were a lot of riots in the 80s. Punks were getting hit on the head and thrown in jail. Police were on horseback breaking up riots.
Yeah.
The Sheriff Hennessy said, punks lip off. And cops don't like to be lipped off to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of, it just, when we saw that quote, we realized, oh my God, that's really a lot of clarity behind that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's a punk rock fan.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, I'm really happy that we could include him in it. And I think he was excited to be part of it.
Now, I want to pause for a second here, get some mechanics out of the way. Jack, I put you in control of this high-tech CD player here.
Oh, sure.
It's a Sony boombox. It cost me $99.
I'll be careful.
Circus City. So anytime you feel moved, you got that stack of punk CDs in front of you, throw something in. We'll play it and talk about it. And first, I think it's also important to find out who these prolific writers are. Silke Tudor, you worked in San Francisco at The Weekly, the alternative paper, for, what, almost 10 years as a columnist and reporter?
I worked there over 10 10 years. I had I was a columnist for 10 years.
Yeah. Uh huh.
I did almost everything in that building at one point or another.
And do you acknowledge the receptionist phase, or has that been written out of your history?
No, I'm proud of my days as a grumpy receptionist. Yeah, definitely. I was a receptionist there.
Very bad mood,
and
though.
I would sort the mail and scour, glower at people.
Is that a conflation of scowl and glower?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Scour.
Well, I did a little searching online, and I found a little Valentine that Jack wrote about you when you left the Weekly, and he did describe you as a very intimidating receptionist. He said he used to tiptoe around you, hoping to avoid, you know, rattling your cage or getting some sort of a response.
Yeah, I don't know whose bright idea it was to have me greeting people off the street at the office. Because I was usually really hungover and pissed off about something.
That was my first impression of Silke, was I do not want to get her mad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to go in and get my mail. Maybe I'll even leave through the back door.
Yeah. Now, Jack, I've known you more. You were the editor of the Nose magazine, which was something I really valued here. You gave me my first virtual trip to Area 51 on the radio.
Oh, that's right.
Remember that?
I do.
Also, the Nose, and forgive me if this is too trivial, but one of the things I remember from it is you had a monthly feature about celebrities' refrigerators. You'd take a picture of what was in somebody's fridge. And I just thought that was really whack, and one of the more unusual things that I'd seen.
And you, it was an inventive time.
Yeah. And you don't seem to recall that.
You know, people come up to me, and they remember certain things out of that magazine mm-hmm. that I've just blanked on. Sure. I don't know why.
No, I mean, I understand that. I've been on radio for many years, and people remember things that I've long ago forgotten. And you reminded me of one this morning. That you came on my rock radio show in the 80s, and we were singing a song to Wayne who?
Wayne Shannon was a conservative newscaster, commentator in San Francisco on one of the local stations. He thought he was extremely witty, mm-hmm. and he wasn't. I don't know. At least my friends and I thought he was kind of ridiculous. So we made up a fan club newsletter for mm-hmm. Wayne, and mm-hmm. we wrote a little song about him and how much we loved him. Yeah. And how much we thought he was really funny, and we look forward to his... I mean, you know, we're in our 20s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we're going to do something like this. But you let us come on the radio and sing it on
mm-hmm.
the air,
mm-hmm.
the Wayne Shannon fan club song. I
yeah.
don't know.
How much did we pay you for that?
Oh, I think I got a cup of water. Much like today, actually.
Yes, I've been exploiting Jack for radio purposes for decades now. And he's yet to get paid for it. Well, let me confess, you open in the introduction of Gimme Something Better with a description of the musical context of the time. And I was part of the problem there. I was working in corporate radio, playing corporate rock. And when I first got to the Bay Area, I was at a station in San Jose, KOME. And we were allowed to play anything we wanted, almost. It wasn't quite free form, but they had a big library, and we were allowed to play stuff. And at the time, this was 76, 77, things were just starting to surface. Elvis Costello had come out and was defined as punk. I don't know if you remember this. Tom Petty was considered a punk act when he and the Heartbreakers first surfaced. I never understood that, but you know, Rolling Stone and mainstream publications like that pigeonholed or tried to characterize Tom Petty as punk. But it was the Sex Pistols who really got my attention. And our competitor, K-San, went punk for, what, about 6 weeks or 8 weeks before Metro Media Management found out and said, what the hell are you doing? Get that shit off the radio. But there was not much support from the media. KUSF, a college station, where Howie Klein had a late-night show, was really one of the few places where the local punk scene got some exposure. And I do want to confess that after I got finished with a shift of playing Journey and that Starship crap and all that, you know, really bad stuff, I would listen to the Stranglers, the Clash, Sex Pistols, Buzzcocks, all that's what was in my car. And those were the shows I went to when I could. I saw the DKs a couple of times. I remember once at the Fillmore, a really great show. But your book really evokes a lot of things that I knew about or had heard of but didn't personally witness. I only went to the Mabue Gardens, I think, three times. But, you know, I certainly did understand the scene. And what you have done, Silke and Jack, is collected interviews with all of the people who are part of the scene, not just the musicians and, you know, the people who were on stage, but the people who were the business people like Dirk Dirksen, who promoted shows, Howie Klein, who really was a major player, went on to run Reprise and Sire Records, and his 415 Records had some of the original local punk acts on it. So that's my confession to you. And so I'm trying to make amends here for all that bad corporate rock and promotion of Journey. It still turns my stomach.
Don't stop believing.
So, Jack, I see you loaded something in the CD player there. What do you got for us?
I did. I want to play the Avengers because when we were putting this book together, we listened to a bit of them. They're one of the greater bands.
Penelope Houston,
one of the more popular bands of the early era. But this is before Dead Kennedys.
Mm-hmm.
So should we play it now and then we can talk about it later? Okay.
Yeah. And they stand up.
Right, they stand out.
They're still some of the greatest music to come out.
Now, the Avengers are going to play at your book launch party. Is that right?
Penelope Houston is putting together a band. I believe she might bring Greg, who is the original guitarist of the Avengers.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, why are the Avengers important, and why do they never break through? They never really broke out of San Francisco. They were signed to a major label, but
Well, Silke and I were talking about this. If the Avengers had gotten popular and the Dead Kennedys didn't, I think it would have been a very different landscape of punk for the next several years, mm-hmm. in the Bay Area at least, because the popular band influences whoever else is listening. Silke, do you want to talk about that?
What broke them up was drugs and failed romance. I mean, that's what split them up, right? That's why they didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But in some ways, you know, at the time, women didn't front hard rock bands. Joan Jett, Pat Benatar, they really benefited from the glass ceiling, I think, that Penelope Houston scratched or broke for them.
Well, there was definitely Blondie. There were a couple of other female-fronted punk groups in the Bay Area and in New York. But, you know, they just caught some bad breaks. They were smart. They were all art students. The music industry was pretty shifty then. Not that it isn't now necessarily, but the punk rock music industry was kind of non-existent. There were no punk rock labels necessarily, mm-hmm. and the first people who started them, it was just a very questionable world. Mm-hmm. There was no ethics. A lot of people in this early era of punk rock, certainly in the Bay Area. The labels were run by coke dealers. There was one label that had signed some local acts. The owners disappeared to South America.
Oh.
Nobody's ever heard from them again. So if you're like a band who is talented like the Avengers, you kind of got caught in the middle of that.
Mm-hmm.
And like Silka said, drugs and failed relationships compounded the matter, I would suppose.
Now, speaking of record labels, you're sporting an Alternative Tentacles T-shirt today, Jack. That I never fully understood. Was that owned by the people who were in the Dead Kennedys, or was it just a, you know, a business affiliation?
It was started by the Dead Kennedys.
Mm-hmm.
They were partners in a label they formed to put out their own music initially. And now Jello runs it himself, and he has a whole list of artists mm-hmm. on the roster. And I think they're actually having a 30th anniversary in mm-hmm. November. But I was over there going through their archives, and they threw me a T-shirt.
Nice. Now, who are the other labels that, you know, spawned some of these San Francisco punk acts in the 70s and 80s?
Boy.
I saw one, Boner Records from Berkeley, on a CD that you brought.
Boner Records was started by the band Fang to put out their own music.
Uh-huh.
And eventually they also ended up signing the Melvins, another probably sort of well-known act.
Yeah.
They had a great compilation on Boner Records called Them Boners Be Poppin', which is pretty cool. I don't know. Some of the local labels here, you know, they kind of came and went, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, Alternative Tentacles is still around. Boner, I think, still sells mail order. And Lookout Records, which came later.
Remember Lookout, yeah.
Was where Green Day got their start. It was centered in the East Bay, and it was put together by a couple of guys who were fans of punk, and they started signing these unknown bands that circled around the Gilman Punk Club in Berkeley mm-hmm. as it was mm-hmm.
pretty
first
much
starting.
Their friends. They signed their friends.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Silka, what else do you want to add here in terms of the business structure or the commerce around punk music?
I have nothing to add about business structure around punk.
Well, but that's part of the issue here, that there it was kind of haphazard and chaotic.
Initially it was friends putting out their friends' records, you know, and nobody thought anybody would make any money out of it. And that was sort of how Lookout eventually imploded, was because they didn't think they would make money off of it. And when they did, they were totally unprepared for what that would mean.
Right.
And Larry essentially threw up his hands and ran away, because it was just it was not what anybody was looking to do. Nobody thought anybody would care.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as all of that attention came, they couldn't keep up with the orders. Everything, you know, it fell apart.
Yeah. Now, what's your take on Howie Klein? Because, as I mentioned, he gets various treatment in the book. And I've known Howie for a long time. I was a big fan of his non-punk act on 415 called Wire Train, a band that came out of San Francisco. And then he went on to Los Angeles. He worked for the big boys at WEA, Warner Electro Atlantic. And, you know, by all accounts, I think he was pretty good to the artists that worked for him. But what is his reputation on the punk scene, as you looked back and talked to many of these people, Silka?
Most everybody considers him a businessman, you know, and sort of an opportunist.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to be the general consensus.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It worded in various ways, but
you can say them. We're not being censored here today. Well, and there's one interesting story here that you tell from Klein's point of view. The Sex Pistols were coming to San Francisco. Bill Graham was promoting the show, and they were looking for an opening act. And Malcolm McLaren, who, of course, was the manager of the Pistols, apparently had a conversation with Howie Klein, and Howie recounts it this way. Malcolm McLaren came over, and he goes, "Who's the worst band in the scene?" And I said, "Well, Negative Trend." And he said, "They're god-awful?" I said, "They're absolutely god-awful." He said, "Can they play?" I said, "No, not at all." And he said, "Okay, can you find them for me?" And then somehow, I don't know the punk rankings here, but they ended up as the headliner for the show, and the Sex Pistols played before Negative Trend. Now, was this McLaren's sneaky way of making the Sex Pistols look better than a local punk act?
I have no idea. We tried to interview Malcolm McLaren. He lives in Europe. And I got a hold of his assistant, and we weren't able to get his side of this. But, I mean, we're hearing this version from Howie Klein, from several people who were there, from Roz, who was the singer of the band Negative Trend, who was pretty confused. He was pretty excited that they were going to be actually headlining a show with the Sex Pistols, because nobody's ever heard of Negative Trend, really, outside the West Coast. And the Sex Pistols ended, the show was over, the band Negative Trend was basically shoved outside with their equipment, and they had no idea what was going on. And then they were allowed back in, the lights were on, everybody's leaving, and so they just started a food fight, basically.
Now, let's take our listeners to the Broadway section of San Francisco, North Beach. It's got a lot of strip clubs, some old Italian restaurants. Francis Ford Coppola has his building nearby. The City Lights Bookstore, which is the epicenter of the beat movement, is right there. And the Mabuhay Gardens was a Filipino restaurant and not a very big place. But it, for various reasons, became a real focal point for punk bands at the early stage and kind of hung with it, Jack, on into the 1980s.
Well, it was, from what we can tell, the interviews that we did, it was one of the first punk outposts in the United States outside of New York. There were bands playing there in 1976, and when the Ramones came through town in 1976, they played for a show of about 12 people in San Francisco's North Beach, just up the street at a place called the Savoy Tivoli. All the people who went to that show ended up starting punk bands in San Francisco. Or they had thought of doing a punk band, but they weren't sure how they could do it. There was nobody there up on stage playing really fast songs that you know, they could relate to. Mm-hmm. All the kids who were into punk rock in the Bay Area in the mid-70s were reading it out of magazines. They had this overwhelming sense of hippie rock left over. All the hippie bands were still around playing in bars. And these kids were, you know, they were influenced by magazines and some import records that came through record stores. But the Mabuhay initially bands booked themselves there before it became this sort of punk ground zero, I suppose, for the Bay Area, because it was a Filipino restaurant. It had kind of a tiki theme. It was they were desperate to get some entertainment in there. They had no idea how these bands would do. So two bands, one called Crime, one called the Nuns, booked themselves at this little Filipino restaurant in North Beach, and they did pretty well, and people were starving for something like that in the Bay Area. And it was new. There was like a definite sense of Art Institute initial kind of influence into that scene. And so the Art Institute is really right up the street in North Beach. Yeah. So it was a short walk for the students to come down and check out the new thing.
You reprint poster, just a second, Silke. You reprint a poster here, Friday, September 25th, Lude, and that's a Christian cross. I don't know what that really
that
means.
That stands for the band Crucifix.
Crucifix at the Fab Mab. And then stenciled along the right-hand side, if you don't know, don't go.
Right. I think they're referring to the fact that this fish symbol is actually the logo for the band Flipper.
Oh, okay.
And then the crucifix is the cross. And they
I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, you can't go then.
I guess not. Those who know, know. Well, let me read here. Right below this poster, Gary Floyd says, "When we first moved here, I didn't know those guys. The Dicks were playing at the Mab, and Will Shatter jumped on stage and grabbed the microphone and started singing along. I ran over and grabbed him and kicked his fucking ass off the stage and said, 'Start your own fucking band.' Later on, a friend said, 'That was the guy in Flipper. He fucking loves you guys,' and told him to start his own fucking band. He has a band. Bigger than your band." Now, this kind of captures the chaos and I don't know, I guess the lack of structure because, you know, there was no real dividing line between the stage and the audience. And so the audience was very much a part of the scene, and it wasn't too hard if you wanted to jump up there. You didn't have to be Kanye West.
Well, that still exists today. I mean, that was kind of one of the hallmarks of the Gilman Club when that opened in the late 80s, that there shouldn't be a wall up between the audience and the performers. So I suppose it was a new thing when it started at the MAB, but there's been, you know, several generations of punk kids who've grown up with that as their primary ethos, I suppose, when they go to see a show. If you know the words, even if you don't, jump on stage.
Yeah.
You know, it's for everybody.
Well, and that interactivity, one of the big shows that I saw the Dead Kennedys perform was at the Fillmore, but it wasn't called the Fillmore at the time. I don't remember exactly why. Bill Graham wasn't in control of it.
The Elite Club.
Yeah.
It was called the Elite Club for a brief time, and they did punk shows there. Same building.
And maybe 1,000 people there jammed up against the stage. A lot of people were jumping up and then stage diving. And Jell-O was stage diving, and he was wearing steel-toed workers' boots, construction workers' boots. And I had to back away from the front of that audience because I really didn't want to try to catch him boot first. And people were coming away a little bloodied and bruised from it. And I guess those were battle scars that they were proud of. But that whole scene, the mosh pit and the stage diving, certainly it's a graphic memory, but it didn't appeal to me.
That was part of it. That was part of the you know, and the it was pogoing in the late 70s, and then it was mosh pits in the 80s. And that was just part and parcel of what happened at a show and why you would go to a show.
Mm-hmm. And Silke, as you looked back at this, was that part of the attraction for people?
A lot of people would go to any show if there was a pit, you know? I mean, you'd go for the pit as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So that adrenaline and that release and that sort of camaraderie as well within the pit was the highlight of it, you know?
I'm going to play a song by Bad Posture. I think it kind of illustrates what we're talking about.
Goddamn motherfucking son of a bitch! 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 I can't move, I can't twitch! Goddamn motherfucking son of a bitch! I can't move, I can't twitch! Got 38 points in my head! Watch me go and save me dead! Got 38 points in my head! Watch me go and save me dead! Goddamn motherfucking son of a bitch! Goddamn motherfucking son of a bitch! Goddamn motherfucking son of a bitch!
And that's about the whole song, right, Jack?
It is. That's the entire song. But that's the kind of music, you know, that was popular in the 80s. There was no commercial potential. It was all about the live show.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to that a lot when we were putting the book together.
That was one of my favorite songs when I was a kid, you know, when a lot of the radio shows were taped onto cassette tapes and circulated. We would give them to each other and keep them in Bad Posture. Yeah, that song was, I guess I must have been 14 or something. It was one of my favorite songs.
Yeah. Where did you grow up, Silke?
I grew up in San Francisco.
Uh-huh. So what was the first show you went to?
I would have no recollection of who played. In fact, that seems to be the case with most of the shows I went to. People tell me I was there and... You know, I was a drunk punk, so I don't know, usually remember.
And have you had any aided recall, you know, gone for ticket stubs, notes, friends' recollections, or you just say, I don't know?
Yeah, my friends remember a lot. Some of them seem to have amazing memories and collections of flyers and all that kind of stuff, but I never kept that stuff.
Uh-huh. Now, one of the things I found in the book is some people were putting out fake flyers about punk acts that didn't exist and shows that weren't going to happen. What was up
with
that?
Winston did that.
Winston Smith did that. He was a graphic artist for a lot of the Dead Kennedys records. That collage style, he kind of pioneered that. Hmm. You see it a lot now. And he's still in San Francisco, and he does posters and books and things like that. But, mm-hmm. yeah, he was a young graphic artist, and he saw this style of poster being up around town, and he thought, well, what the hell? So he would put up flyers for bands that didn't exist, or the address would be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean,
uh-huh.
and just as a lark. But, you know, his posters look better than most mm-hmm. already.
Yeah, I do wish I had some of those flyers.
Now,
beautiful.
I'm trying to remember, the Frankenchrist album was a German artist, right?
Swiss,
okay.
Right.
So did Winston have anything to do with Frankenchrist, or was that...
No, I think that was the band, the Dead Kennedys, wanting to just sort of mix it up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But Winston did their logo, which is still a classic punk logo you see on jackets and graffitied around the world. And then years later, Winston was asked to do artwork for a Dead Kennedys album, mm-hmm. Insomniac.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really cool.
Green Day.
For Green Day. What did I say?
You said Dead Kennedys.
Ugh. I'll just go to sleep now. Sorry.
Now, you brought an early Green Day collection.
Oh, yeah.
Jack, why don't you whip that out for us? And I'll just mention that Jell-O did get a lot of publicity and a lot of hate mail for the Frankenchrist cover. But at the time, I had him on my political talk show on KNBR right after Rush Limbaugh every day to defend his First Amendment rights. And it was interesting because some of the Ditto heads, who clearly had never been to a Dead Kennedy show, never heard the music, actually did pipe up in support of his freedom of expression. And I found that gratifying.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, it was a court case that was kind of a landmark in the music business. Can we put artwork on our record album, you know, that we want to put on? And woman and her children bought the record. They brought it home. She was offended and outraged. Started a big stink about it, and all the Dead Kennedys records were pulled out of chain stores throughout
mm-hmm.
California
mm-hmm.
immediately.
Yeah.
And they were banned. And so that was the basis of the lawsuit. So the upshot was, you know, Jell-O and the Dead Kennedys won the lawsuit, but the band broke up in part because of this. There's a lot of legal fees. And, you know, although they did win the case, the Tipper Gore's PMRC,
mm-hmm.
designed to protect young people from the evils of rock music.
The Parents Music Research Council.
That's right. They convinced the music industry to put that sticker on anything that was deemed offensive, mm-hmm. which, of course, if you're a young kid, that's the record you want.
Yeah. I had an unusual encounter with Tipper Gore. For people in the Bay Area, there's a guy named Ross McGowan who is retiring now from a morning TV show. But in the 70s and 80s, he was co-host of an afternoon chat show on Channel 5 here called People Are Talking. And I got a call at the radio station about 10 o'clock in the morning saying, can you come on the show this afternoon? We want you to debate Tipper Gore. And I said, oh, really? Okay. And so I went over there, and we were on the set for about 20 minutes together. And Tipper was quite disarming. Because she said, oh, no, 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 it's not about censorship. It's about giving parents the information that they need. And she told the story that she had been at breakfast with her daughter. I guess this is Corinna Gore, who's, you know, an adult now. And the song by Sheena Easton, I think, called Sugar Walls, came on. And Sugar Walls was a reference to female intimate parts.
That's offensive to me. I'm sorry.
And so Tipper said, at breakfast? Ew! Anyway, it was a remarkable time because she was proposing a very clear censorship program while trying to say, oh, it's not about censorship at all. And I remember asking her, I said, well, Mrs. Gore, what about the unintended consequence here? You're going to be putting a sticker on recorded music product that says, buy me, because it's got dirty words in here. And she said, oh, no, 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 it's for the parents. It's for the parents. I said, sorry, Tipper, parents don't buy music. Kids do. And when they see this, that it says explicit, then they're going to want it even more than they did before they knew that. And she didn't have much of an answer, and that did prove really to be the true outcome of those stickers and that whole effort.
I mean, if I was a kid growing up in an era where there were stickers on records, that would be my record collection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least you know you're getting something that's straight from the artist's mouth.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so you loaded up some Green Day there. Tell us about this CD.
Oh, this is one of their first records. This is actually a song by a band called Operation Ivy, which Green Day, it was just before Green Day. They were pretty popular, and Green Day covered one of their songs. And they still play this live in Green Day shows. I think almost every concert they still play this song.
By the way, the mouth noises are on the recording. We're not doing that.
I know things are getting tougher when you can't get the top off the bottom of the barrel. Why don't Ben run in my future now? It's fucking, fucking barrel. All I know is that I don't know. All I know is that I don't know nothing. All I know is that I don't know. All I know is that I don't know nothing. We get taught to decide. Just like as if I'm not gonna change my mind. All I know is that I don't know. All I know is that I don't know nothing. All I know is that
So have you seen the rock musical or rock opera, the Green Day? It's based on their American Idiot collection, Jack?
I have not. I've heard it's pretty good, but no, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the free tickets, then I'll
go. I know it's been extended already. They got a slew of press, New York Times, Rolling Stone. I mean, everybody wrote about it as soon as the play debuted, opened, and they extended it through November. So it's already selling well. So
Silke, in the punk community, Green Day, sellouts, the ones who broke through, is there jealousy? Is there respect? Or is there just a lack of interest?
I think that the opinions have changed over the years. I think there's, you know, most punks, I don't think, regard what they do as punk anymore. And I think that there was a lot of jealousy and animosity because they sort of blew the scene up. You know, this intimate sort of family that existed in the East Bay got all that attention, and it sort of tore it down, you know, when they became something else and went on to greater fame. But I think over the years, Green Day has really proven themselves very loyal to their home. And that has counted for a lot. Like they've given a lot back. They've stayed in Oakland, and they became, you know, more politically their convictions kind of came through a little more on later albums. And I think that, you know, these people that knew them started to have warm feelings about them again. You know, as they grew up.
Right.
And now for both of you, take a moment here and tell us about what happens when punks grow up. Does anything happen?
We were amazed at how a lot of people turned out that we interviewed. There is a really high number of people who have gone on to try to do something good in this world for their community. There were a lot of lawyers, counselors, professors, teachers, psychologists, a psychiatrist. It was really surprising. I mean, and it shouldn't be surprising, but you know, we're talking about a period of time where most people are in this world, their age 15 to 23 or something like that. They don't continue to go to mosh pits when they're in their 50s necessarily. And I don't know. It was it's nice to see that, you know, people who are teaching creative writing at UC San Diego used to be in a stinky little punk band in Gilman, you know? It's nice.
Silka?
I mean, punk naturally drew intelligent kids, you know, intelligent creative kids who sort of thought outside of social norms. And I think that a lot of them, when they grew up and started to apply themselves to sort of an adult world of, you know, what they were going to do for work or what they drew on punk, you know, and they came up with really good ideas and are creative in their fields and interesting and still a bit transgressive. Like, I feel like a lot of them are and still very engaged politically, a lot of them, you know, the ones that didn't die or go to prison, you know, because there's that element too. And a lot of them didn't make it, you know. But the ones that did make it, that didn't kill themselves in some way, all seem to have really contributed in interesting ways. You know?
Now, I want to ask if the Tubes had any impact on any of the punk artists that you talked with, because they were clearly not a punk band. They were a glam rock with satire, and, you know, Quaalude, the lead singer, was really out there. And I will confess that the first time I saw the Tubes, I was on Quaaludes, and they opened for Brian Ferry and Roxy Music, and it was Halloween in Chicago. Wow.
Very cool.
Now, I was very impressed by them because of the, you know, all the theater and the props, and their songs were loaded with social commentary. I'm just curious, did they have any impact? Because they were kind of in a class of their own, Silka.
Those early shows at the MAB were sort of set up like almost like cabaret. I mean, there was, you would have all different kinds of things happening. You'd have, you know, comedians and strippers and dancers and, you know, and a punk band. Like, there was a lot of that theatrical. So, yes, in a way, the Tubes did have a big influence, and a lot of the kids that went on to have punk bands that were going to shows back then dug the Tubes, you know.
And their first single was called White Punks on Dope. From what people told us, The Punks on Dope was there was a group of people in the Bay Area, young people who called themselves Pods, and they kind of loitered around areas. They had long hair and they smoked pot and took acid and walked around the streets in flannel shirts or Levi jackets with the flannel, the fur lined inside. And, you know, they were kind of Goombas in a way. They were sort
of just white trash thug kids.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, exactly. So some people have theorized that the Tubes noticed that and added the white part.
Yeah.
And, you know, rewrote lyrics so that, you know, it's more about kids from Hollywood who are white punks on dope. But the Pods, you know, they existed all over the Bay Area. I've talked with many people who said, oh, yeah, I was a Pod. You know, they're wandering around bored out of their minds, high, looking for something to do. And this was the mid-70s, basically.
Well, and the Tubes...
elementary school, everybody's older brother was a Pod.
Well, and the Tubes did break through commercially. I don't think they were ever successful monetarily because they spent it all on the next show and all the, you know, the backup singers and all that stuff. But it was kind of an interesting point. Now, let me ask you, moving forward, did the grunge scene in Seattle take any influence from the San Francisco punk scene?
Well, I interviewed Chris Novoselic from Nirvana, and when he was a kid, he was listening to songs, albums by the band Flipper that came from the San Francisco punk scene. Flipper was intentionally dissonant from what was going on for the most part in the punk scene. They played slower songs. A lot of their sets ended in fist fights. Everyone was really high. It was this kind of sloppy, drunk and stoned, dirgy kind of a sound that was just very different than, say, the Avengers of the Dead Kennedys, and they were playing at the same time.
They purposely tried to disappoint and piss off their audience.
Right. They went out of their way to make people hate them or make people walk out of the room. And just for some people, that was really punk rock. They're purists. You know, they could care less.
Now, I'm at your website right now, and I want to recommend this to our listeners. GimmeSomethingBetter.com, G-I-M-M-E, and then the rest of it spelled English-wise. GimmeSomethingBetter.com. And you have a playlist here of punk tunes, and I just pulled up Flipper. But do I have to sign up first, Jack? Is that what I failed to do?
Yeah, I think you do. But we have another Flipper song on this CD here.
Okay. But I want people to check this out because there is a rich repository of San Francisco punk available right here on your website. And again, that's GimmeSomethingBetter.com. And I'll post that link in the show file related to this program at PeterBCollins.com. So what do you
got? This is a song by Flipper called Sacrifice.
So that's Flipper. The band is Sacrifice?
The song is just called Sacrifice.
Ah, okay.
But you get a sense of Flipper. You know, they are still around. They just released two new records this year.
Really?
And they toured the Vans Warped Tour.
Uh-huh.
They were touring around the United States. They went to Europe for a tour.
So they found an iPod audience.
There you go. And I think there's a lot of interest for older punk bands. There's kind of a revival circuit. A lot of these early bands, you know, have found a young audience of curious kids who want mm-hmm. to find out, wow, what was going on back in the late 70s, early 80s. You mentioned the Mutants.
Right.
They also play occasionally
yeah.
still. And
I saw the Mutants at the Art Museum in San Francisco had an Andy Warhol exhibit. And on a Friday night, I just was there to see the Warhol art. And they were playing in the atrium there. And it was great. It was a really cool combination of Warhol's work and that feel from that punk era. And they were wearing big hats and, you know, trying to work on some of their old shtick.
They were another group that kind of carried that cabaret idea from the Tubes into the punk scene. They were mm-hmm. art students. They dressed up like chickens for Thanksgiving. They always had a different theme or a costume. Mm-hmm. They would, before a show... Lead singer Fritz Fox told us that he would go to the Strand Movie Theater in San Francisco on Market Street, watch some Russ Meyer movies, and smoke a bunch of pot, and they would mm-hmm. conceive of what they were going to do that night for the show.
Wow.
I have to take off, you guys.
Silke, before you go, I just wanted to ask you one thing. You're there in New York now. You relocated or dislocated. is there any punk scene? CBGB closed, right?
Yeah, it sure did. It sure did. There's a horrible sort of rock art gallery in there now.
Uh-huh. Oh. Just selling T-shirts?
Like prints.
Yeah.
Photographs.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so, you know, Jack just mentioned that Flipper has kind of found a new lease on life and some of the punk bands are finding a new audience. Is there any subculture in New York right now supporting it?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. ABC New Rio is still around and there's, you see, like, if you go to Tompkins Square Park, which had always in the 80s and 70s had punks hanging out in it. This summer, a whole big, huge crew of gutter punks came through that had been train hopping across the country. So, I mean, they're everywhere, you know, the kids all the time. The patches and the graffiti, they're around.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Silke, thanks for joining us as you wander the streets of New York. Great to talk with you, and congratulations on a fabulous new book.
Thank you so much. Nice to meet you.
You bet. Good to have you on the program. That's Silke, not Silky, Silke Tudor, co-author with Jack Boulware of this new book, Gimme Something Better. Now, I meant to mention this when we were talking about the Mabue Gardens, but in the book, Jack, you recount that one night Stan Getz dropped by.
Somebody in a band told us this.
You can talk over this.
Oh, sure. He showed up drunk. I suppose he was after a gig or something. But this is Stan Getz, the groovy jazz saxophonist.
Yeah.
Hopped on stage with a punk band called the Emetics. I'm not sure if he knew anybody in the band. Played a song with them, then went out the door of the Mabue around the back and got a blowjob from somebody.
Can we get to the saxophone part here? Come on, it's here somewhere. Well, he's on there somewhere.
Right. He found his own girl from Ipanema in the alleyway of North Beach.
Any other interlopers, unusual people who dropped in on punk shows?
Well, in the early days of punk rock in San Francisco, the mayor's daughter would come to shows. Mayor Moscone, the one who was later assassinated at City Hall by Dan White. His daughter and this socialite crowd would come to North Beach to see what the new thing was.
Mm-hmm.
They'd heard about this new thing, punk rock, and there was TV specials about it. There was documentary, little vignettes on local news. You know, what is this new punk rock thing?
Mm-hmm.
Channel 5 has the answers, you know, tonight at 11. So people would see that and go, oh, maybe, you know, we're open-minded Bay Area people. Mm-hmm. Let's go see what the kids are up to. In that early era, all the rock stars of the era would come through. David Bowie, Iggy Pop, Blondie, Devo, all these people would come through. And that was an early matriculating place for people who were in the know. And that's when we're talking that era. That is really the tip of the iceberg for what the history of punk rock is in the United States. But it... you know, it was new. It was there was something happening. The fashion was new. The sound was new. The language was new. There was a different value system that was emerging. And people think, oh, punk rock back then. Oh, everyone was spitting on people, right? Well, that's a part of it, yes. But there was also some brilliance and creativity.
Yeah.
Every step of the way, there has been.
Now, I had never seen this until you brought it in today, but there is a punk version of West Side Story called Punk Side Story by the Schlongs.
Just Schlong.
No, the?
No. No, okay. Their band is named Schlong. They had they were from the East Bay, Gilman era. They had gained some notoriety for punkifying songs that you would not suspect have any punk rock to them. They did, and it... Fleetwood Mac's Rumors album in its entirety on a 7-inch. It was about 14 minutes long, and they called it Tumors. They did a Steely Dan cover band, and these are all punk rock versions of all the songs. Mm-hmm. They learned all of these songs and then deliberately destroyed them with punk rock. They did a Carpenter's Greatest Hits in a punk rock format. And so...
I wanted to select Maria.
Oh, I actually have that queued up. This is Schlong. They... got all their friends together, wrote the music, arranged it, rewrote the lyrics, cast it, recorded it in 2 days, performed it once. That was it.
Let's hear it.
Maria, most beautiful sound I ever heard.
That opening belch was touching.
Maria. Sounds the world in a single word.
Now, Jack, as you made the description, and as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking of The Residents. The Residents were not a punk band, but they were the most unusual band on the San Francisco scene when I got here, which was in 76.
Mm-hmm.
And their version of Hank Williams' Kalijah is something that is one of my all-time, like, top 10 favorite songs. And I've only seen The Residents twice. It's a bizarre production. They do theme things. I saw their James Brown show. And Buckethead is the guitarist, and he famously wears an upside-down Kentucky Fried Chicken bucket.
KFC, right.
On his head. And do we know who the lead singer is? I'm trying to remember between the mythology and some of the things I found out afterward.
You know, the Residents didn't come up on our radar for this idea necessarily for this project, but they're very San Francisco in that they're very smart and quirky and deliberate and very arty, and everything is a big production.
Mm-hmm.
All the members are anonymous. They all wear giant eyeballs.
Right.
I remember going to a party when I first moved here in the early 80s, and someone had stolen one of their eyeballs and was showing it off at this house party. We have one of the Residents' eyeballs! And they refused to ever list their own names.
Right.
I think they were one of the first bands to release a CD-ROM back in the 80s, early 90s.
That.
Do you?
Yeah.
They were really trendsetters ahead of their time. They're one of those, that group of artists that, you know, they're talented musicians, but they always insisted on living 10 minutes ahead of everyone else. And, you know, I think for the artier elements of the punk scene, they certainly were aware of the Residents.
Sure.
You could not ignore it. If, you know, you lived in the city, someone knew someone who saw the Residents the night before.
Yeah, and let me put this out to listeners. If anybody knows the current status of the Residents or you've seen them in the last couple of years, send me an email and let me know about it. Peter@peterbcollins.com. Well, Jack, what have we missed here? There's a lot in this book that we don't have time to talk about, and there's much more that didn't fit in the book that's on the website at gimmesomethingbetter.com. As we wrap up here, what would you like to leave people with?
Well, I suppose this is a book that people are asking, why should we do this now? Why is there interest in this now? Well, I think, you know, Green Day is, of course, kind of at the forefront of pop music at this point in time. This is a book about how they got started and who influenced them and what they listened to when they were little kids. And, of course, you realize that nothing happens in a vacuum. There wasn't just Green Day born. They grew up in this world of East Bay punk kids who helped build their own punk rock club. The Club Gilman in Berkeley was built by kids. Yeah. They were pounding the nails, installing the toilets, putting in the wiring, painting the place. They helped build it. I mean, that was such a unique thing for people in the rest of the United States. This was DIY taken to a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
It really was. And it's exciting when you realize that, you know, that was allowed to happen, and that, you know, it's still run by volunteers today.
Mm-hmm.
It's still run that way. After 20-some years, it's most punk clubs just go out of business. They burn down. There's some tax problems, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, for better or worse, this all-ages club in Berkeley is still going. And, you know, that was a starting point for a band like Green Day. It was also a starting point for a lot of crazy, wonderful, weird music that never went anywhere commercially. But like the band Schlong, who does Punk Side Story there, it was a breeding ground for a lot of fascinating creativity.
Yeah.
And it still is that way today. It's still open. And, you know, we're actually doing one of our book events there at Gilman.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and when is that? Is that upcoming? Let's get the plugs in. Come on.
The book actually launches September 29th. It's available to the public. You can pre-order it online, of course. Our first event will be at the Mabui Gardens upstairs space called the On Broadway, which is a very legendary punk space in the 80s in San Francisco. And we're doing a show with Porchlight Storytelling Series and the Litquake Festival. This is October 12th. We're bringing in people from the book.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who's coming in is actually been interviewed in the book, and we're having them come up on stage and tell their own stories.
Oh, that's great.
And then afterwards, we'll have Penelope Houston of the Avengers play a set.
Mm-hmm.
And then the following night, we're at the Booksmith with Frank Portman, who was a member of the band The Mr. T Experience. And he also has a new career as a novelist. Mm-hmm. And his first book, King Dork, was actually optioned by Will Ferrell.
Oh, really?
For Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And his second book, Andromeda Klein, is just coming out. Frank will be there with us. That's October 13th, playing music, acoustic music, and hanging out with us. And then Saturday night, we do, this is October 17th, we'll do a big launch party at the Gilman Space in Berkeley. The band Schlong will appear.
No.
And also the new band, I'm blanking on their name, with Jesse Michaels. Jesse wrote the introduction to our book. He was also in the band Operation Ivy, which was a Gilman band. It was very, very popular in its day. It was kind of a ska music meets punk rock, very musical, very political at the same time. So Jesse and Schlong, and there'll be some other bands added to the bill. And I think on October 20th, we're at the San Francisco Public Library, and we're doing a slide lecture Q&A. It will not be a lecture. We're not going to lecture anybody about this.
Mm-hmm.
I've given a couple of talks already, and I just start asking people what you'd like to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Ask me some questions, and yeah. Let's just talk about it. I mean, we're not pontificating about punk rock and that we are the master historians of all time, but we did interview over 300 people and rolled about 800 hours of tape,
mm-hmm.
Or digital megabytes or whatever. And only a portion of it made it into the book, but
yeah.
We put a lot of the extra chapters. I think there's over 25 extra chapters on our website,
mm-hmm.
so people can check it out.
Well, Jack, this has been a lot of fun. And I thank you and Silke for putting this together. What, 3 years this has been in the works?
3-year journey, uh-huh. Yes.
And it's really satisfying. And as I say, it reads like a conversation among all the people who were part of the scene. And I think you did an incredible job of editing together all of these snippets of interviews so that they flow in a conversational way. So I hope people will get a hold of the book, pick it up, and actually pay for it. It's called Gimme Something Better, and again, the longest subtitle I've seen recently, The Profound, Progressive, and Occasionally Pointless History of Bay Area Punk from Dead Kennedys to Green Day, and we're going to give Roy Rogers a rest today and head out with the Dead Kennedys' California Uber Alles. Thanks for listening to this special punk rock podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show.
Get some air.